It's 7:43 on this West Virginia morning. I'm Teresa Wills. During this year's legislative session, we asked you what energy and environment issues were on your mind. We got some great responses, but many questions were about West Virginia's renewable energy policies, like Huntington, West Virginia resident Jennifer Least. She asked,
"What are the obstacles keeping West Virginia from advancing with more renewable energy in our state? What can we do to help with the problem?"
This is West Virginia Morning. This year, lawmakers debated a handful of different bills related to solar energy. One proposal that could exponentially increase the amount of solar installed across the Mountain State passed, but not everyone likes the bill. Our energy and environment reporter Brittany Patterson explains.
The question before the House then is, shall the bill pass? Those in favor of passage of the bill will vote aye. Those opposed will vote no. The clerk will prepare the machine.
That is the sound of the first renewable energy bill being passed by West Virginia lawmakers in 5 years.
Has every member voted? If so, the clerk will close the machine and ascertain the result. On that question, there were 75 ayes, 23 nays, 2 members absent not voting, a majority of members having voted in the affirmative. Chair declares the bill passed. The clerk will please report the title.
Committee substitute for Senate Bill 583.
Are there amendments? Senate Bill 583 creates a utility solar program in West Virginia. Under the proposal, the state's two electric power generators, First Energy and American Electric Power, can each install up to 200 megawatts of solar power in 50-megawatt increments. 200 megawatts is enough to power about 28,000 homes. Currently, the Mountain State only hosts about 8 megawatts.
I would say we made some incremental progress this year, and that is a good thing.
Autumn Long leads the West Virginia chapter of Solar United Neighbors, a national solar advocacy group. Long says passing a utility solar bill is a big step for West Virginia, which is ranked 48th in the nation in the amount of solar installed statewide.
It does open the door for large-scale solar development. So it is a landmark year in our legislature, in so much as leadership and the rank and file lawmakers are really recognizing the need for West Virginia to step up and get in the game with renewable energy development.
Officials with the West Virginia Commerce Department requested the bill. They told lawmakers having access to solar was one of the most important issues for new businesses when they considered whether to move to the state.
There's a huge driver, all the companies out there that have the renewable corporate sustainability goals, and they're not going to come to West Virginia.
Jimmy Van Ostrand directs the Center for Energy and Sustainable Development at West Virginia University.
But you say, well, no, we have a bill now, actually, that utility will go out and procure just for you whatever you need. I mean, that takes away one huge barrier that we had.
He says the utility solar bill makes it as easy and low risk as possible for utilities to get into the solar game. The bill requires the Public Service Commission to permit projects within 150 days. It also helps utilities recover costs of solar installation. The PSC estimates residential customers could see bills rise about 18 cents per month as a result. But the bill doesn't mandate utilities install solar, Van Ostrand says.
This bill does not require them to do anything. So it's a little bit of smoke and mirrors when they're saying, oh, 200 megawatts each for each utility, 400 total.
In an emailed statement, a representative for First Energy said the utility supports economic development in West Virginia, and if a customer expressed desire for solar, would, quote, then begin to investigate the options. AEP did not respond to a request for comment. But if you want to put solar panels on your roof, but have a company install them and lease the power to you, something called third-party solar or power purchase agreements, you can't. Van Ostrand explains that is still illegal here in the state.
This is solar for the big guys, really. I mean, it's solar for the big guys.
There were some legislative initiatives that tried to address that, but they failed. Another bill that incentivized solar on reclaimed coal mines, the Mojo Act, also never made it out of committee. Karen Ireland is a lobbyist with the West Virginia Environmental Council.
You know, I had been fighting so hard to get power purchase agreements, to get that bill on an agenda and get it passed. And it seems like such a reasonable thing.
The utility solar bill dredged up bitter debate among lawmakers, with some fearing solar could displace coal. The bill was amended to include language to ensure it doesn't. Ireland says that shows the legislature still has a ways to go before it fully embraces renewable energy. Long, with Solar United Neighbors, is a little more optimistic. She hopes once lawmakers see solar boosting the state's economy, making solar more reachable for everyone might gain traction.
So it's a first step that I hope will encourage our state's leaders to really be open-minded about more renewable energy policy that can encourage this industry's development in future years.
Senate Bill 583, opening the door to utility-sized solar investments in the state, now awaits the governor's signature. For West Virginia Public Broadcasting, I'm Brittany Patterson.
The Ohio Valley. As the economic fallout from the coronavirus continues to reshape our lives, small-town business owners are worried about the future. Reporter Sydney Bowles takes us to Whitesburg, Kentucky, where a town already struggling from the decline in the coal industry grapples with new and serious challenges.
Whitesburg has been dealt a tough hand. The Appalachian Regional Commission considers Letcher County, where Whitesburg is located, to be distressed because of its high unemployment, high poverty rate, and low per capita income. But Whitesburg is a fabulous little town. I know because I live there. It's got lots of public art, there's a great walking trail along the river, and it's full of people who are passionate about building a diverse and sustainable community after coal. All of that's to say, Whitesburg is fragile, and the economic fallout from the coronavirus is likely to destabilize this place and places like it harder and faster than in larger cities. One thing that's already having an impact is the ban on dine-in services at restaurants.
Heritage Kitchen.
Amber Bailey is a server at Heritage Kitchen, a restaurant in downtown Whitesburg. She makes her money on tips, and that means her income has nosedived.
I'm one of the lucky ones. Like, my boyfriend works, has a, you know, a full-time job. But I have a lot of friends who work in the restaurant industry. They're servers and bartenders, and they don't have anybody else. So I'm more worried for them than I am for myself.
Brad Shepard owns Heritage.
Our primary business that we make money from is dine-in customers. We've always done some level of delivery and takeout, and that's all mostly supplemental income to the dine-in.
Shepard plans to stay open for takeout and delivery for 1 month and then reevaluate, but he's worried if the crisis goes on for longer than that, he'll have to shut down. Just like Amber Bailey, Shepard isn't just worried for himself.
It takes all of us to really keep a vibrant downtown going. So losing anyone downtown permanently would be a devastating blow.
You know, I don't foresee every business making it through this. There's just no way.
That's Allison Davis, Executive Director of the Community and Economic Development Initiative of Kentucky at the University of Kentucky. Her organization has helped rural coal-reliant communities transition away from fossil fuels, as well as prepare for crises like natural disasters.
When we've talked with communities in the past about being resilient to disaster, this is not the type of disaster that we've tried to prepare communities for.
No one can say how long this crisis will last or how intense the suffering will be. Still, Davis says, rural communities have real strengths that can help them weather the hard times.
It is the local people right now that are determining their chance of success post this disease. And so I get excited because I know some of these communities, they have really rallied. And this is not like, oh, we should start getting together. It is, we have been together. We know each other. We know our strengths. We know our informal and formal leaders. Like, we're going to figure something out.
Back at Heritage Kitchen, server Amber Bailey is already thinking about how to support her community.
I posted last night on Facebook, if we end up shutting our doors here, then I can help some of my other friends who may have little ones where their daycares are gone.
Bailey still has hours, and she still knows exactly how I like my burger when I call to order takeout. But projections show unemployment in rural Kentucky is already skyrocketing, and it's only going to get worse. Across the street, downtown pub Streetside has laid off its servers indefinitely. For the Ohio Valley Resource, I'm Sydney Bowles in Whitesburg, Kentucky.
The Ohio Valley Resource is made possible by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and West Virginia Public Broadcasting. West Virginia Governor Jim Justice's latest executive order reacting to COVID-19 means non-essential workers need to stay home, but some small businesses are able to remain open, including a wine and cheese bakery in the Northern Panhandle that imports products from Europe. Good Mansion Wine has been operating in downtown Wheeling since 2006. The shop recently expanded to include a bakery and lunch deli, closed currently to dining in, but still open 7 days a week and offering curbside pickups. Glennis Board spoke with an owner, Dominic Cerrone, who has family and business partners in Italy. Here's part of their conversation.
Outside your own shop, what kind of government policies do you think are critical going forward for small businesses? Are you speaking with other businesses dealing with this crisis?
We've reached out to several businesses, but also, probably more importantly, some of the community organizations that are kind of quasi-governmental to encourage the population now to think hard about the impact of this virus on not only the health of the community, but the economy of the community. And to maybe begin an initiative and a collective discussion about where you're shopping today is going to impact the way your community looks after this pandemic. This is not a short-lived pandemic. This could be a way of life for a while. Small businesses, small restaurants, small retailers, as long as they're able to be open and that they're deemed essential, are dependent on that cash flow. And small businesses have a lot of cash flow. And if you want the economic diversity and the diversity of product in your community, you have to really ask yourself, what do you want your community to look like after this? And if you are comfortable with just having a Kroger and a Walmart and gas stations, then go ahead and shop at those. But if you're intent on having access to a much broader selection of quality, then people really should be thinking about the economic health of the community. Mm-hmm. And I argue, without being a medical expert, that I honestly believe, and people at our stat shop honestly believe, there are health benefits to shopping locally because you're much more able to keep your social distancing and kind of stay healthy in smaller shops if you can get what you're looking for at those smaller shops rather than the big box supermarkets. So that's not to say that if somebody has to go to 10 stores to get their needs, that might be any collectively better than just going to one store. But if you're going out using the instance of Good Mansion Wines and you just basically need some wine, a couple fresh, baked items and some dry goods for a dinner, whether that's pasta or rice or canned tuna or whatever, if that can be done at a smaller shop, you should really think hard about whether for the economic health of the community, but also for social distancing, if it's a good idea to go to the large retail shop or to support a local business and be able to also keep your distance.
Dominic, is there anything you want to add about Italy, about your family there, and about the folks you're working with? Any other observations or insights that you might have?
I can certainly say, as residents, as citizens of the world, we deal with small Italian families. They're all family businesses. These are very small enterprises with very high quality product. And, if you're interested in helping out an economy that's kind of at its brink right now, then that's another reason to consider coming in and supporting Good Mansion Wines because of the efforts that we make to connect to those families. It's very hard. I have family in Milan. I have family throughout. I have family in the medical field. I have family that's a senator in the Senate in Rome, and their life is very, very compromised right now. And what's most concerning is hearing what's happening there and realizing that within a mere several weeks, we could be living the same kind of life is very, it really makes you want to kind of, as Dr. Fauci said, go where the puck is going to be, not where it is right now.
That was Dominic Cerrone, an owner of Good Mansion Wines in downtown Wheeling, speaking with Glennis Board. West Virginia Morning is a production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting, which is solely responsible for its content. You can keep up with the latest West Virginia news throughout the day on our website, wvpublic.org. Support for our news bureaus comes from West Virginia University, Concord University, and Shepherd University. Our news director and producer is Glennis Board. I'm Teresa Wills.